that is where somebody wants to make a difference.
Oh, yeah.
There's lots of things.
Yeah, there's one. And we don't actually need to have.
Oh, okay.
Call Senate Labor and Commerce to order. It is Saturday morning, the, what is today?
Ninth.
The ninth, thank you. May 9th, 1992. Present at the moment are Senators Kraft, Collins, and Pierce. We do have a full schedule today. We will probably be meeting on and off throughout the day, so I would appreciate everybody's tolerance and patience with us. We're going to first do Senate CS for second CS for House Bill number 18, second Labor and Commerce CS. It's a Luckhopt 5892 work draft that you have before you, and I'd like to go ahead and adopt the work draft.
I have a question about the current work draft. Does this work draft incorporate the amendments that the committee put into it, or have any of those amendments been dropped?
No. All of the amendments are in this corrected CS.
Okay, but I was looking for an amendment, but I couldn't find the amendment we've done.
The architects?
Yeah, where is that?
That's a good question, but I don't know.
I don't see it.
Billy, where's the architects provision in this?
It's page 8, line 20.
It is section 7. Page 8, beginning on line 19.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the draft annotated Luckhopt 7LS0268/Y dated 5892.
Okay, there's a motion to adopt the work draft. Anyone opposed? No. Okay, we have it before us. The reason that we have this draft is that the drafters made an error in preparing our CS that we passed, and they had not deleted, even though we had made the amendments, they had not deleted the psychologists and psychological examiners sunset date, nor had they changed the sunset date for the social workers in 1995, and that's on page 8. Line 7, the Board of Clinical Social Work Examiners has now been changed to 1995, June 30th, 1995, which was our amendment. They had also, we had inadvertently not made the formal motion to drop another section about psychologists that needed to come out of the bill because that's dealt with separately in the psychologist bill. So the new CS that you have before you has basically only got one change, dropping the psychologist section from what we had actually passed. So this has been checked by ourselves, also by Representative Greenberg's staff, by the division, by all the lobbies. Kind of everybody at this point's been over
it. To find your phone.
Representative, I'm sorry, Senator Pochot plans to waive it from finance, but we need to go ahead and move this second Labor and Commerce CS so that it's on the first step. No, we don't, because we officially have it now in this bill back and forth, so we just about to move on to that
one. Madam Chair, I move that the Senate Committee substitute, the Second Committee substitute for House Bill 18, Second Labor and Commerce, move that committee with individual recommendations and the attendant fiscal notes.
Okay, there's a motion to move the bill yet again. Anyone opposed? Okay, that's gone. I'm going to sign that so that we can get to the,
sure,
the clerk, so we make sure it happens. Okay, we're going to bring up House Bill 574. We do have a work draft, also dated 5892. And you have a sheet that looks like this. I'm sure that yours is right over there on top. You've got one that looks like this. Okay, this sheet tells you what is in and out and or amended in our draft. I'd like to go ahead and adopt the 5892 Luckhopt Kramer B as a working document.
And I'm trying to move that we adopt the Senate Committee substitute for House Bill number 74, Labor and Commerce, the Luckhopt Kramer Work draft noted 7LS216-1/B, dated 5/8/92.
Okay, there's a motion to adopt the work draft. Is anyone opposed? Okay, very quickly, I'll just hit the high points of what's in versus out. We do have a number of people who want to testify. We will have both Terry Kramer, who did the legal work on the APUC regulations in this work draft. We also have Bob Lohr from APUC here to testify. And we'll probably do that before we have all the other testimony, because I know that some of it's going to relate to the APUC sections. Under the bill that came over from the House, many sections were deleted. I think I'll just talk about the ones that we left in. We did continue to allow occupational licensing by statute to the department can increase fees to cover full administrative costs without board approval. That is in. We kept the APOC ability to establish fees through report statements and filings, and we amended that in the limitation section 2. Page 3 says that the fee established under the paragraph should reflect but not exceed the actual cost of the commission of the activity for which the fee is charged, so that they would not be able to go beyond the pale in terms of charges. We do allow in the CS the Department of Labor to establish fees for their asbestos certification program. We do continue to allow the Department of Motor Vehicles to increase their fee for the ID card, not a license, but a national driver's license, the national ID card from $5 to $10, which will cover their costs. The other Division of Motor Vehicles fee schedule changes are not in the CS. They were not necessary for the Senate's version of the budget, so we remove them. Section 5 of your bill on page 3 allows the Department of Corrections to establish fees for telephone use by prisoners. The department wanted this language in. The drafters weren't sure it's absolutely necessary, but the department very much wanted it. It is still there. Section 6 relates to Department of Natural Resources. Section 6 remains the same as the bill that came over from the House. DNR will be able to accept cash and other donations from public or private sources to assist and support the department carrying out the purposes of this chapter. That's park fees primarily. Section 7, we did amend. We had some requests on page 5. The department will be able to charge for admission to visitor centers. They will be able to charge for firewood, for use of a developed trailhead, or a facility that has parking, restrooms, and refuse collection. And also, you can see they would be able to charge for attendance at programs. The House bill, as it came over, would have allowed the department to set fees for the use of just every pullout virtually along the highway, any highway, and turn those into campgrounds, even though they might not have had any sort of facilities. And we deleted that section of the bill. Sections 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13 all relate to the APUC. I'm going to allow Terry Kramer and Mr. Lohr to explain those sections. Section 14 allows the Division of Telecommunications to charge for the commercial transmissions on state systems. That is something that is necessary for both the House and the Senate budgets. The following section allows the Office of Public Advocacy to establish, I'm sorry, we took that out. Department of Corrections can recover costs for publications. That's the next section. They also can charge reasonable fees for training. Section 28, the Rick Schultz Memorial section, is not in this bill. Section 29, former Section 29 has become Section 16. We will allow the Lieutenant Governor under this CS to establish a fee for notary publics by regulation. The Section 17 allows Department of Natural Resources to charge temporary fees this summer, since they can't have their regs finalized. And then that repeals in Section 18 2 years after the effective date of the bill, so that they have time to get their get their regs done. Section, new section 18 repeals the statutory power right now that licensing boards have to veto their fees. And then the last four sections are the effective date sections. We ask the drafters to effectively repeal the APUC sections December 31st, 1994. The APUC is up for sunset next year. I predict a large sunset bill, and I think that the legislature should revisit how we pay for APUC since both the House, since the House sent us the bill and the Senate budget also calls for APUC being paid for through fees, we're pretty much stuck with it for the time being, but we repeal it as of December 31st, 1994. We will be back at the table next year to figure out what the best system really is. So that's what's in the CS. What I'd like to do is have Bob Lohr and Terry come forward, if you would please, and talk about the APUC provisions, walk us through the changes we've made and how they would work. Are there questions from the committee in terms of what's in or out?
You could pull up a chair here if you want to be right now.
Yeah, you can probably just pull up. Okay, if you would, first of all, if you'd each identify yourselves for the record, please.
I'm Terry Kramer. I'm the drafter of the Public Utility Commission portions of this bill from Legal Services.
Hi, my name is Bob Lohr, Executive Director of the Alaska Public Utilities Commission.
And we're not on teleconference, so neither one of you have to worry about this mic.
Good.
We can just be real people.
Lovely.
Terry, would you please walk us through the sections that you drafted for us and explain, A, the changes, and B, how they all fit together for us? And if we have specific questions for either you or Mr. Lohr in terms of, and I'd also like him to have the opportunity to make some comments he'd like to.
Okay. The PUC sections start with Section 8 on page 5. The first change happens in subsection A, which used to have a set percentage for exempt utilities as the amount of the regulatory cost charge. Instead, this version says in the last sentence of subsection A, an exempt utility shall pay the actual cost of services provided to it by the commission, so that at the time that services are provided, the commission would come up with what that cost and presumably bill the utility. There were some language changes in subsection B to reflect some of that. Down in lines 27, 28, we refer to that. Oh, the other change that was made in this draft is to clarify that what the commission is entitled to collect from utilities, be they regulated or unregulated, is the portion of the commission's budget that goes directly to services to utilities. That's found in lines 25, 26 and reflected throughout. Subsection C was not changed.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Section 4205.253 is public utility regulatory cost charge, and then page 7, section 11, that's the pipeline carrier regulatory cost charge. If we looked at line 26 and removed the and pipeline carriers from that language, and on page 7 in section 11 remove the public utility from the pipeline carrier, then would we
would be an appropriate choice to make if you wanted to. It would,
that would
at
work.
This point, the draft says the commission figures out what it costs for it to regulate both pipeline carriers and public utilities and may not collect more than that total figure. It doesn't try to apportion between the two. You
okay.
Could go the other way.
If I could just explain the question. There is some concern since in terms of the pipeline carriers, this is a direct tax that's obviously going to be paid straight back to the consumer. So will that for the other utilities. we will lose tax revenue because the pipeline carriers are profit-making corporations, and there'll be a loss. We want to make sure that we don't, I think it's important to make sure that we don't end up in a situation where those pipeline carriers are carrying a disproportionate fee for the total cost of the EAPDC because they are looked upon in some cases as being still a golden goose by virtue of the fact that it's they're either have gas or crude or some sort of petroleum products flowing through. So we're interested in trying to level that playing field.
We could certainly do that if that's the committee's choice. Subsection C addresses particular problems that may arise in establishing a regulatory cost charge. Or in paragraph 2, for local exchange telephone utilities, you deduct the cost that it talks about. Subsection D refers to regulated electric utilities, and it allocates the total cost for regulated electric utilities among those utilities according to how much power they sell, rather than their costs or revenues or whatever else you might choose. I don't think there were changes to the rest of Section 8 for this draft. Section 9, there were not changes to. What it does is, when, after a hearing, the commission is allocating costs, it directs that they consider what the utility has paid under this regulatory cost charge that we create. Section 10 is there because of the sunset. It goes back, it's a companion to Section 9. It restores Section 9 to the language as that language is in law now. So those are the three public utility sections. Sections 11, 12, and 13 are the pipeline carrier sections. And in subsection A, we increase the percent to 0.61 to parallel the percent that's in the public utilities section. That's on line 21 of page 7. And in subsection B, as Senator Pierce pointed out, we make the changes for allocating the costs that are directly related to providing services, and it would be appropriate if the committee wished to apportion the costs for pipeline carriers to pipeline carriers and the public utilities for public utility.
It's my understanding, and I don't know if we have any now, but it's my understanding that under APUC rules, pipelines, particularly natural gas, have the right to exempt themselves, just as electrical utilities do. I don't know what they have to go through, but they have that right. I would think that we need to carry that exempt utility and electric costs too. But we can talk to Mr. Moore about that.
Section 12 and 13 are companion sections as the PUC sections were.
Okay. Are there questions, legal questions for Terry this time?
No, I think the questions have been more for Mr. Lohr.
Okay. Bob, you want to tell us how this affects you in terms of dollars and how the APUC would go about setting those tariffs and then ask some questions on that?
Thank you. Senator Pierce, members of the committee, my name is Bob Lohr, Executive Director of the APUC. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of the Alaska Public Utilities Commission concerning House Bill 574, specifically Sections 8 through 13. These sections establish a regulatory assessment or user fee, which would be set at a level to produce revenues equal to the APUC's legislatively approved budget. This assessment is a fractional percentage of the gross revenues of each public utility and pipeline carrier operating in the state, which cannot exceed 0.0061 for regulated utilities. A total of 44 states use this approach to raise money to cover the costs of utilities regulation. It is consistent with the principle of cost cause or cost payer. The customers of a public utility or pipeline benefit from the lower rates and better service they would receive in the absence than those what they would receive in the absence of regulation. The cost of this service to a customer, that cost necessary to cover the FY93 budget of the commission, would be 47 cents per $100 worth of utility bill. If your utility bill is $100 a month, you'd end up paying 47 cents toward this cost of regulation. Some have argued and will argue that this gives the commission some power to aggrandize itself to build up its budget. In fact, we think the opposite. The effect of linking the costs with the service is that people tend to pay more attention to whether the service is appropriate and necessary. And we believe that if, for example, heaven forfend, the income tax were restored, people would pay a whole lot more attention to what services those tax dollars were buying than they tend to pay through general fund, which is a much less direct, tangible connection to their costs. The implementation of these provisions would need a set of regulations, and I'm sure the utilities and pipeline carriers would participate actively in assisting us to design that. Essentially, the principles involved are keep it simple and keep it fair. Using gross revenues as a measure for regulatory activity is not perfect, but it is a reasonable one, and it's simple to calculate. It's something that utilities and carriers already calculate on an annual basis for reports that they file. It would be fairly straightforward to compute what the cost would be of these services and to allocate that to each carrier, each utility. In turn, there's provisions in the bill, I believe they're still there, that allow utilities to pass these costs through to their customers. And that's arguably where the costs belong, in terms of that's where the benefits are received. I need to think a little bit about some of the changes that have been made in the CS, and maybe it'd be better if I come back to those later to comment on the effect of those, specifically on some of the language changes to subsection B of each one, the direct targeting language. The preliminary question I have in that area is, if there's a regulatory proceeding that benefits utilities or pipeline carriers generally, how would that be apportioned under this? Would it be an allowable expense? Or is there some category of commission expense outside of what the language in these two sections talks about? If so, there's no source for it at this time. And given the way the budget has gone, as you suggested, Madam Chair, that would be a concern to the commission. If there's a mandate there and no source, obviously that's a concern.
And it's not our intent to not allow you to do business, clearly.
The sunset provision, or the repealer provision in the law, is of concern to the commission. In looking at all other provisions in Title 43, the taxation provisions, we were unable to locate an example of a tax or fee that had a sunset or repeal date built into it. And in looking at other state statutes, nor were we able to find that type of repeal there. It certainly makes sense to examine this and whether it's working. And I believe under the closer scrutiny that we expect, you'll be hearing about it if the payers of the fees are concerned, and that the sunset process is an appropriate place to consider those. The requirement to have separate substantive legislation causes the commission concern in that, just like this year where we have a budget but no ability to collect it, we would be potentially in that situation. Now, I do believe the date that's specified in here at least would give us one session's worth of warning. But I worked in the nonprofit sector for most of my career, and I know the feeling of not having a source of funds. In this case, having a mandate to do business and having a lot of projects that need approvals contingent on that mandate, I believe it's appropriate for the legislature and the governor to provide adequate funds to operate. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions from Mr. Ward? Okay, great. We're going to go into the talks. We have to come in before. And Terry, if you don't mind, why don't you stay with us? And Dave Hutchins signed up first. Do you want to testify?
Yes,
okay.
I'm Dave Hutchins, Executive Director of the Alaska Rural Electric Co-op Association. And I'm sure it'll come as no surprise to the committee that our membership does not like the idea of this new utility tax at all, but that recognizing that the budget presumes that this is going to be in place, my mission here today is not to oppose the imposition of the tax at this time, but it is to try to make it as livable as possible. And I want to thank the chairman and the staff for the work you've done in at least listening to the concerns we've had and responding to most of them. I would say that we enthusiastically endorse all the changes that you've made in the utilities section of 574. We have two other suggestions, one of which I know is controversial, so I won't advance that today. The other one I think would be essentially non-controversial if I'm able to explain it clearly. You will have that in your packet as Eureka number 4. If you can pull that out and deal with the typed version of the language rather than the handwritten addition to it, because with other changes that have been made in 574, the handwritten portion would not be appropriate now.
Just a moment while we shut the papers.
Eureka number 4?
Yes, this would, in your CS, that would fit in at the bottom of page 6 and top of page 7. You'd be deleting the underlined language and replacing it with new language on line 3, just before the period on line 3. That would say, but it shall not apportion costs to regulated utilities. And the idea here is that, yes, the commission needs to have this section of law to be able to apportion costs to other participants in these various hearings, like interveners and so on. But once a regulated utility has this fee or tax imposed on it, it should not have to pay twice for being the subject of being involved in a PUC hearing. And these are not small amounts that our members are going to be taxed. Chugach will pay almost $500,000 a year. Golden Valley will pay more than $250,000 a year in this tax. So these are not small amounts. And then to charge them an allocation of the cost of a hearing in addition to that just does not seem reasonable.
Ms. Hutchins, tell me again where your language would fit in the draft CS.
Okay, the new language would fit on page 7, line 3, just before the period, on line 3. And that would be replacing what is now new language starting in the bottom of page 6 and the top line of page 7.
So what would be deleted?
The new language, the underlined language.
So in allocating the cost, the commission may consider the results, ability to pay, ability to pay, other relevant factors, and mitigating circumstances, but it shall not apportion costs to regulated utilities?
Correct.
Well, okay, go ahead with your explanation.
Well, it's just that the current language in here, the new language being proposed in that section, seems to tell the commission that, well, maybe you ought to take it easy on the regulated utilities if they're paying this tax. But from our perspective, once they're paying this very substantial amount of money as the new tax, then they should no longer have to pay the allocation of costs for these hearings. It's charging the regulated utility twice for
around. Who would you have pay for the hearing? I mean, if this is a hearing for instance, let's say it's a case before APUC about Chugach.
Chugach will have already paid its share of the cost of the operation of the APUC through the regular budget process, and it shouldn't pay again because some intervener comes in and runs the cost of the hearing up.
And is that chapter 651A just for interveners?
It's for hearings.
For any hearing or just for?
It's a hearing or investigation. You have the full language of 651A right there before you.
Okay, but What I think you're saying is that if a third party comes in and asks the APUC to look at something about Chugach, and so the APUC says yes and holds the hearing, you don't want Chugach to have to pay for that hearing. So you would just allocate those costs overall to everybody?
Well, when they're paying almost $500,000 a year in the taxes or fees, I think they've already paid their share. That these would just be a part of the general operating budget.
This would be considered part of the direct cost.
Right.
What about if Chugach came before the APUC with a specific rate case? That was Chugach's case, and there had to be an
exception. Yes.
Or anybody else.
There again.
Certainly not fair for the GVEA people have to pay for the Chugach rate case.
No, but the Chugach, by paying the nearly $500,000 a year, will have paid their share. And that's what the commission does, is have these hearings.
Right.
And for the routine course of business, that they should be covered as a part of the APUC budget. But they do need this authority to be able to allocate costs to other parties that come in and run the cost up.
I understand what you're saying. I don't think I agree with it in that if one utility, for whatever reason, comes in to have its rates changed, then I think that should be dealt with separately and should be charged for separately than the regular, particularly let's say we have somebody who comes in and then the next year they come back, and if we have a particular utility, any Wednesday that perhaps keeps the Public Utilities Commission busier than others. Does it seem fair to spread that cost statewide?
Well, I would tend to agree with the chairman on that, that in principle we would rather see the cost allocated on a cost cause or cost payer basis if we're going to have to pay the cost directly from the utilities. However, the whole thrust of this section is to get away from that approach and to spread the cost across the state based on the gross revenues of each utility. And that's the whole thrust of this thing, is to have a standard tax or fee that supports the PUC. And having the hearings are a routine part of their daily business.
Okay. So that's your weakest proposed amendment. We'll ask Mr. Ward to respond to that. I'm not sure how we get out of that particular ticket. And what else?
Just in conclusion, I'd say that of the changes that you've made in the CS, from our perspective, the most important is to have the sunset on this tax so that it comes up for consideration at the same time as the PUC does. And we commend you for that and urge you to stay with it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Dave? Okay. Next on the Philip Gray from here in Juneau.
My name is Philip Gray. I live at 4410 North Douglas Highway in Juneau. I just have to find for myself. I'm opposed to some of the parts in here on the fish and game fees. I think that maybe they're asking the little guy to pay instead of looking at some of the commercial operators. I think maybe they're... I don't
Mr.
like
Gray,
double...
Excuse me. Do you have a copy of the CS? Because I believe we've removed all the sections on fish and game fees. And that they're not reflected in any.
I got a CS for House Bill 574 Finance AM.
Yeah, that's the House version. The new Senate, the work draft for Labor and Commerce removed all of those charges for fish and game fees.
Okay, so there's going to be no changes in fish and game fees then?
That's correct. Under this under the CS, we amended we took out the guide licensing fees, and we also took out the resident sports hunting and fishing license. There are all raises in those costs, and we do not add a king salmon tag.
Okay. Then probably the only other thing I've got, maybe a couple things. I got a question here on this boat trailer fee. I'm not sure what page it's on. But they want to raise that from $5 to $25. A lot of the people here that have small skiffs maybe launch their boats just several times a year, and it seems like that's quite a large fee increase, five times what it is now. In fact, it seemed like quite a bit to me. For $5, you only drive a few miles on the public highways and you launch your boat 3, 4, 5, 6 times a year, that seems like quite a jump for a small boat trailer.
Okay, I believe, sir, that that has also been amended out. What section is it in that, in the bill you're looking at?
Seems like a five to ten.
We took out all the... The only motor vehicle fee that's left in this bill is the change of the identification card fee from $5 to $10.
Okay, so you took out the boat trailer entry.
Right, boat trailers, big trucks, little trucks. All of those are out.
Sorry, I didn't get this new amended version here then, so if you...
Okay.
Taken that out, that's about all I've got to... Thank you.
Okay, thank you. For the record, Senator Hassidus, join us. Juanita Helmsley from Vision Public Safety. Juanita Bus.
I believe she left.
Okay. We took them out of the bill, so they just went right. Steve Lewis, special star.
My name is Steve Lewis. I'm the CEO of PetroStar Inc., also the CEO of the PetroStar Valdez Refinery Joint Venture. Under the work draft that was given to us this morning, I have two major sections that I have problems with. Section 11 is 4206. It deals with the pipeline carrier regulatory cost charge. And section 12, 4206.610, which is the allocation of cost. There are several concerns I have relative to this particular section. As I understand it, we'll only deal with the intrastate shipments of crude, which are under APUC jurisdiction. When I said crude, I should probably restate that as far as pipelines, interstate jurisdiction under APUC for pipelines.
Intra or inter?
Within.
Okay.
Within the state. At least as best I can tell, this may only affect PetroStar in North Pole, Valdez, and MAPCO, and Fairbanks. There's a good question as to whether it would affect the Soro or not, because they ship under full pipeline tariffs. And I know that's an issue that's been in front of the APUC for a long time as to who has jurisdiction. The other question that I have, I think is somewhat discriminatory, is that all crude that is shipped to outside of the state where the product is brought back into the state would not have any tax associated with that. The other thing that I think is potential is that under this bill, I think that the refineries in Fairbanks will be taxed twice. Coming down the pipeline, they will be taxed from the pipeline carriers on TAPS. They will be taxed again under the Golden Valley pipeline that goes from TAPS into the two refineries in Fairbanks. That's somewhat unique in the fact that those two refineries are the only refineries that actually take off of two separate pipelines, one owned by Alyeska owner companies, and the other one, Golden Valley Electric Company. Problems that I see are specifically relative to the refineries that are dealing in state in Fairbanks and Valdez. And I spoke with the APUC on this, but I never was able to get any clarification. They couldn't answer the questions either. Relative to the Golden Valley tax, and also whether or not the Soro would be included under this tax. Section 12 deals with allocation of cost. Currently, all hearings in front of the APUC, specifically relative to pipeline tariffs, usually involve MAPCO, Tesoro, PetroStar. And currently, what happens is that after a hearing, after certain dockets have been heard, they split up the costs and allocate those to the people involved in that hearing. Under this bill, the allocation of the cost just states that commissioners shall consider regulatory cost charges paid by the pipeline carrier. When in reality, who pays the fee is the shipper, and in this case, the refineries. And so, as it looks like to me, what they're giving is a kind of a credit to the pipeline companies when in fact they'll just roll that into the tariffs and the refineries will wind up paying that. Contrary to the utilities, we can't roll that into a rate base automatically. The fact that we operate under a system where we have to compete in the marketplace, and especially on the coast where we're looking at product coming in from Point Wells and other locations outside that are using the NS who are not coming under this tax. It seems to me somewhat discriminatory toward the in-state refiners. As far as a recommendation, after talking with the APUC and other people around, it doesn't seem to be any real clear-cut fast fix to this. I know that there would be problems allocating, I believe, this to all inter- or intrastate shipments. If that could be done, that would probably take care of it, an elimination of double taxation where it goes from one pipeline into another going into a refinery.
Okay. Why don't we do this? Why don't we ask Mr. Lord to come up and you both stay up here. Tell us how this section would work in terms of who would and would not be taxed and who might be taxed twice versus would product being shipped outside not get taxed at all.
I'll do my best, Madam Chair. The regulatory charge, or if you will, tax, is assessed on intrastate shipments because those are the shipments jurisdictional to the APUC. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and federal law preempts jurisdiction over interstate shipments, and it would be inappropriate as a matter of policy and probably illegal for the state to tax those interstate shipments of oil to support regulation which didn't regulate those shipments.
Okay, yeah, can you stop right there and tell us what that would be that we can't tax?
That would be a
petroleum products.
Right. It would be in excess of 96% of all the oil that goes through taps. Approximately 4.25% of the oil shipped in Alaska is intrastate destination. And it's based on the point of consumption or the point of transformation, if you will, where it's refined or something done to it, not based on the point of sale. And that does mean that in-state destinations are the ones that would be assessed this fee. The rate under the work draft committee substitute would be the same as that for public utilities. It would be 47 cents per $100 worth of gross revenue. The problem I had in responding to Mr. Lewis's questions on the phone were that he couldn't tell me what the gross revenue would be. And I said, if you know what the gross revenue is and you apply this factor, 0.0047 times that gross revenue, that would give the figure of what this would cost the refinery, assuming that 100% of the cost were passed from the pipeline carrier through to the refiner, or the shipper in this case. And I believe that is analogous to how it would work on the utility side. Now I answer the double taxation question.
Okay, we need to recess to go to the floor. We'll recess to the college chair. What I'd like to do, if we can, is come back and push on through this as soon as we come off the floor. And if you all have any inventive ideas on... Okay, let's call Senate Labor and Commerce back to order. It's about 7 minutes after one. We were in recess. Present at the moment are Senators, Kraft, Collins, and Pierce. We are still on House Bill 574. We have a proposed work draft CS. I might add... Senator Halford, while he isn't here at the moment, has asked that when Labor and Commerce passes a CS, that we include a section that we had taken out, and that would have been section 26 in the previous bill that allows the Office of Public Advocacy to establish fees. He would like to see that in the bill, so everybody might want to look and see if they have any problem with that. It does not affect the budget, but he thought that
that's public advocacy.
That it should,
why he wants it to be there.
No. Okay.
You want to meet in there?
We had people from Fish and Game who were here to answer questions earlier, but because we took their entire portions of the bill out of the bill, they left. So we're down to APUC, or back to that. And Mr. Lohr, if you wouldn't mind please coming forward, since we don't have Mr. Lewis back, can you please, here's Steve.
Hey, Steve.
Why don't you, Bob, walk us through some of the questions that were on the table before we recessed in terms of the, kind of back through that intrastate versus interstate and who we'd be charging and I guess who we wouldn't be charging. And for the record, Senator Halford is back with us. Mr. Lohr.
Thank you. As I recall, the one remaining question from this morning concerned the possibility of double charges on a barrel that goes through two different pipelines, the Golden Valley example.
And can you tell us how it is that it goes through two different regulated pipelines? First of all, what pipelines in the state are regulated by the APUC? Is there a list?
There is a list. I'd be happy to provide you. It's about 10, about 10 different companies.
Okay, it's got a GVEA pipeline off Taps.
Correct.
And it's got a, I'll let you run
through. Kaparik would be another example.
Okay.
Taps itself for the portion of oil that is intrastate, that is any oil going through the line and being taken out at North Pole.
And that's that 4%?
Right.
And that's
it's totaling 4% from all sources.
And that's the oil at the moment that's being taken out by NAPCO and Petrostar?
That's my understanding.
And nobody else?
Tesoro's refined products, the commission believes, would be covered by this user fee.
Okay. Maybe the way to get to this is just three questions. Why isn't the caps oil that Tesoro takes at Valdez and over to their refinery counted if the MAPCO and Petrostar oil is counted? Because it is in state.
It is counted because it is refined in state. That's correct.
And so it would be taxed.
It would be subject to this user fee, correct.
Okay. Even if the product got shipped out of state?
If it is refined or otherwise treated, as opposed to simply sold in state,
Okay. Then
it is subject to the jurisdiction of the commission.
Okay.
And I have a list in the annual report of those. I can either read it or provide it to you if you wish, of the carriers that are intrastate.
Okay, why don't you make a copy of that for us? So the refineries that are in Alaska presently and operating presently, which I think we only have three, they all three are treated equally in terms of this tax. But the question would be whether they have two pipelines or just one?
They would be treated comparably under this. The differences in geography, if they are taking oil out at North Pole, clearly they're going to be treated differently than if they take oil out at Valdez, simply because of the cost. The tariff is set for part line or full line.
What you would charge?
Those fees are based strictly on gross revenue, which is jurisdictional to the commission.
Okay.
So to the extent that a pipeline carrier has gross revenues, which is typically from their tariffs, that's going to be the source of money which is assessed this user fee.
A barrel of oil taken by either Petrostar or MAPCO at North Pole, and the gross revenue for that barrel versus the gross revenue for a barrel of Tesoro oil, what would be the charge by the APUC to those two separate barrels? I guess that's the way to get to how are we treating differently.
The charge would be to the carrier of the oil, to the owner of the pipeline.
Okay.
The owner has the option to pass those costs through to the shipper. And that's how the cost would end up being borne by the refiner as a shipper.
Okay.
it wouldn't be paid directly by the refiner to the commission. Rather, the owner of the pipeline would receive gross revenues based on charging the shippers the tariff, and then a portion of that would be paid as the user fee for the cost of regulation.
So MAPCO and PetroStar pay this fee because they have pipelines. Tesoro doesn't pay it because they don't have a pipeline?
Tesoro would pay the fee also indirectly, in the sense that they are listed as a carrier on the list that Bill is Xerox.
Okay, then just for that specific portion, Steve, of what you were talking about, how is that unequal between the different?
Well, as far as I know, there is only the only intrastate tariffs filed with the pipeline carriers relative to the TAPS line prior to Golden Valley. I don't think there is an intrastate tariff to Tesoro and Kenai. And I don't believe the pipeline companies, once crude is shipped the full length of the pipeline, I don't think there's any separate, whether Tesoro loads it on the ship, I don't think TAPS decides what crude is going where. I think once it leaves on the ship, it can get it to Tesoro could ship it anywhere. And so I don't think there's even a mechanism of TAPS reporting that shows, and maybe I'm wrong, as far as I know, I don't remember, and I don't have a tariff with me, of an intrastate tariff applied to TAPS other than Golden Valley.
I guess the question that I have is you would advocate a position that we ought not treat the different refineries differently. On the other hand, if one, by virtue of where it is and now it gets its oil, is subject to the APUC regs versus somebody else not being, then I don't know. I don't see how we could change that, because clearly what we're trying to get to is that the APUC charges for what it does, and we can't very well charge somebody that it doesn't regulate for what it doesn't do to them. So,
okay, well, I understand, and that's why it's a very complex issue, because it is. But like I say, as far as I know, and Charlie says I'm correct, that there is no intrastate tariff, because if there isn't an intrastate tariff, then APUC can't rule on it. I will agree that Tesoro has a pipeline that ships product that would come under it. But some of the problems I see is it really takes away some of the value of in-state processing. It takes away, some of it kind of actually even discourages it, because the idea that we can pass a tax on assumes that that everybody is on the same playing field. And, for instance, on the coast, a lot of the product that is on the coast is coming out of other than refineries in Alaska. And if we're on an equal basis now, and that tax is only applied to in-state interest shipments of crude, then our cost is going to go up and theirs is not. And so we couldn't pass that on. Now, I understand, the need for APUC to have funds and everything. But there's tax on products, which goes across the board totally, which is another tax bill. And, maybe at some point in time there could be a mechanism there, but we can't necessarily just recoup the cost the same as the utilities do, because utilities are all on an equal playing field, and that cost goes right into the rate base and automatically increases the cost to the utilities. But that's not the case relative to the refineries, especially on the coast. In Fairbanks, maybe we could turn, MAPCO and us both get hit, we could turn, just increase the tax, pass that tax through. Mm-hmm. But we still pay both taxes. And I understand his position is, even though it's two pipelines, we pay them TAPS and we pay them Golden Valley. It's still a total tariff issue. And if the tariff goes up, but
If I can just try to clarify a couple of points. The annual report required by the commission of all pipeline carriers does require them to break out their intrastate barrels separately from their interstate barrels. Those figures would be the basis for computing this user fee. And Tesoro does indicate a substantial quantity in-state barrels. In fact, all their oil showed as in-state gasoline and fuel shipped.
But that's gasoline and fuel. That is not on the incoming crude.
No, but this is based on gross revenue, and it's based on those gross revenues jurisdictional to the commission. And the commission believes that Tesoro is jurisdictional. The other point as to the effect, we estimate the effect of this user fee to be somewhere in the range of 1.88 cents per barrel of oil. That is simply an estimate, but in terms of getting some idea of the magnitude of this, that's the amount that we're talking about for a user fee sufficient to cover the commission's FY93 budget.
In terms of what you do with pipelines?
We haven't made that sub-allocation yet because that was new language this morning. This is treating as the language was proposed, that is, all utilities and pipeline carriers together to generate the total commission budget. In fact, there isn't even a dollar figure for how much of the commission's budget is pipeline carriers at this point. That would take additional accounting to be able to track costs that way, because it simply hasn't been allowable to use that figure for any sort of allocation in the past, so there's been no attempt to collect it.
States, or do any other states try to allocate costs of their APUCs out and pay for their utility commissions through fees? Have you looked at that?
Yes, 44 states
do that,
and several territories, including Washington, D.C., and they raise a total of 62% of the total amount spent on utility regulatory commissions by that mechanism. They also have cost allocation and some other means. Relatively fewer general funded.
Is the model you used when you were developing your, I know that you, I, it's my understanding, and if I'm misstating, please correct me, it's my understanding that the commission worked with House Finance to come up with this plan. Is the model that was used like at least the majority of those other 44 states in terms of the way you dealt, say, with pipeline carriers?
Yes, that is the model. As several years ago, this notion was proposed, and at that time, the model was based on a survey of all states to determine what mechanisms they used for covering the cost of public utility commissions.
Does NARUC have any sort of book or anything that shows how the different, they pulled anything together that shows how different states?
Yes, they do, and it's a table which is attached to the commission's position paper.
Oh, okay.
The final page of that is the NARUC table that summarizes this.
Okay, back to the specific pipeline issues. That 1.88 cents a barrel additional cost would be for the barrels that are pulled by the in-state. That's not on the full 2 million throughput a day of the TAPS
correct.
Line. That's on
it's
the
only on the
4% barrels that are pulled, the 4% that's pulled up by in-state refiners. Are there any tariffs on the TAPS, the other 96% of oil going through the TAPS line each day and floating away, going in interstate, that are not charged to the in-state refiners that you know of through the, any of the federal tariffs?
If I understood the question, are there costs borne by the commission for interstate shippers of oil.
No, I'm sorry. I was staying at 20 minutes right there. But the other 96% of the oil coming through the TAPS line, that not the, the 4% that stays in state, but the 96% that goes out of state, are there any costs on that 96% that are not borne by the 4% through the federal tariff?
I see. Not that I can immediately identify. The, to the extent that FERC assesses costs of filing, typically FERC uses filing charges quite a bit, substantial charges, as well as, I believe, cost allocation to recover some of their costs. There'd be some comparability there, but I couldn't just immediately guess it, whether there are some that would not be borne by the 4% or not. It's, that is all oil subject to FERC's jurisdiction, which is, under federal law, as I understand it, preemptive. It does not allow the state to regulate.
Okay. And what about the double tax issue?
It isn't a double tax. What would happen is if you have to ship oil through TAPS or through Kuparik and then through TAPS and say, take it out at through Golden Valley, the gross revenues of each of those pipeline carriers would be assessed this fee to the extent they're regulated. But their gross revenue is only going to be proportional to their transit, to their portion of the shipment. So it's not as if you're paying twice for the same shipment with the same barrel through the same piece of line. It's simply that you're paying a piecemeal rate which gets the oil from one place to the other in three different segments, two or three different components.
When a pipeline rate case comes before the commission, do you deal simply, say, with a Kuparik pipeline rate case, or do you deal with a GD, or do you deal with a do you deal with the refinery and what they have to pay through? Is that the rate case, or is the rate case Kuparik, and everybody who takes Kuparik oil ends up in that rate case?
Typically, you get into the limits of my knowledge here. I'll disclaim that I'm fairly new at the commission, so I'm still learning a whole bunch. The cases are typically rate cases filed by the carriers, by the owners of the pipeline, and they would typically propose a rate or tariff, and then the shippers customarily would intervene in the case, typically argue for a lower tariff, and those would be the parties. There may be other parties, but typically those are the parties. Sometimes the commission will designate the staff of the commission to be a formal party to those proceedings as well. On the more complex proceedings, such as the one involving the Quality Bank, the computation of if a shipper takes oil out of the pipeline, a refiner, for example, and then puts the residual stream back into the pipeline, there's a calculation made for reducing the quality of the crude stream as a whole.
Right.
And the computation of that amount is quite, it's a very complex and sensitive proceeding. A tiny change in that rate has a dramatic effect, and everyone is interested in the outcome of those. And those cases go on forever, sadly.
Questions for either Steve or Mr. Lohr? I think if nothing else, this makes a great case for the sunset.
It's up next year.
Well, that, I mean, the sunset of the, and I understand the commission's concern about having their funding mechanism sunset, but I think on the other hand, this makes it clear that whatever passes probably is not going to have, we're not going to have an opportunity to figure out every nuance of it carefully enough to have all the parties feel like they're being treated.
Could I ask for one clarification?
Sure.
Because I'm still very unclear on this particular part. I recognize that Tesoro is reporting revenues relative to pipeline. I believe there's a product pipeline. Is the APUC saying definitely that Tesoro will be taxed under this same rate for shipments when the full mainline pipeline tariff and TAPS
Lohr?
I believe that's what the commission is saying. I would want to take that specific question to them rather than guessing. I talked to one commissioner during the break who confirmed that that was the case. I believe there is case law at the Supreme Court level that product is covered as well as crude oil. That's been settled by the Supreme Court of Alaska. And to that extent, we believe that this is jurisdictional. And our computation, this language of this user fee is based on gross revenues.
Reported by the pipeline company.
Correct. And Tesoro reports this as intrastate.
Yeah, but Tesoro, as I understand it, reports revenues. They have no revenues relative to TAPS. That's a payment to TAPS. But the only revenue they have relative to pipeline is their shipments in the product pipelines. The only revenue that could be shown as revenue that would be taxed on crude oil would have to show as revenue that's reported by Alyeska under an intrastate tariff to the Port of Valdez, and there is none.
Well, I'll try to get back with a specific answer to what is the commission's position, but I gave you my understanding of it, and that is my understanding is that they are jurisdictional and that their gross revenues are subject to this user fee.
Maybe if you figure out what the $100 million in gross revenues on pipelines, out of which you would expect $470,000 in fees, the way you worked out your status quo. Well, that's your estimated to pay for the $470,000 out of pipelines, maybe you can.
That table that was used to generate that has been revised based on the annual reports of the pipeline company. That figure is closer to $113 million, but the amount involved with Tesoro is, I believe, around $6.7 million. So if it turned out it was not jurisdictional, the actual amount available for allocating that user fee would still be in excess of $100 million. The estimates on that table are intentionally conservative to try to have the rate, if anything, err on the side of being high for the user fee rather than to underestimate the rate and have it slip up after the bill is considered.
Okay. Are there any, I guess, Steve, maybe this is you. Does the APUC regulate something that NAPCO or PetroStar does that they don't regulate that Tesoro does?
I believe that this bill does not cover Tesoro shipment of crude down the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
But is that regulated by the APUC?
Is it regulated?
Yeah, if it's not.
It is an ongoing argument that has never been settled between the APUC and FERC. And in all cases, there's never been, to my knowledge, a ruling on that. And most of those cases have always been settled out of court in the settlement dispute. But I do know when we talk about reporting revenues that this bill is going to approach, the revenue that Tesoro is reporting is a revenue on their pipelines, not because they have no revenue on TAPS. The only place that revenue could possibly show up is under the TAPS owners, pipelines revenue, and they don't have a jurisdictional intrastate tariff on full pipeline shipments. They don't even report that way.
I think I understand the PetroStar / MAPCO concern. On the other hand, if APUC doesn't have jurisdiction, then they shouldn't be charging for something that they don't do. So that's what I'm trying to.
So that means that the only people will pay this tax is the APCO and PetroStar in New Jersey.
Which is exactly what we did on the other hand with the electrical utilities, where those that have exempted themselves because APUC doesn't do anything to them, and that's Fairbanks Utilities, and Ketchikan, FMUS and Ketchikan, because they're not regulated, they will not be charged for something that APUC doesn't do to them. And I understand the inherent problem that you've got with it. On the other hand, it doesn't make sense to charge somebody to be regulated when they're not regulated.
But
so
we compete with Tesoro.
I understand that.
But I don't know how to get there, is what I'm saying. So we will keep working on it. But it seems inherently unfair to charge a utility to be regulated when they're not being regulated, certainly. So, but I also understand your problem, so maybe we should figure out a way to get you accepted. I don't know.
Except everybody, then we won't have a problem.
Then we won't have an APUC, and that won't work either. So, Mr. Lohr?
Yeah, we worked as
Madam Chair, this morning Steve made another point concerned about the cost allocation language.
Yeah.
I proposed an amendment to try to address that concern because I think it was valid.
Right.
And essentially it would add shipper to the language about the, right now it says that the pipe user fees paid by the pipeline carrier under AS 4206-285. If instead of paid, the word born was substituted and or shipper was added, it would require the commission to take account of any user fees which were either directly paid by the carrier, as the language is proposed in the work draft, but also would require the commission to take account of user fees shifted onto the shipper of the oil. So it would broaden the category. It addresses the concern that the shipper doesn't have an automatic pass-through to anyone.
Can you, I know it's Saturday, but can you clarify and let us know for sure what the annual report and the question about what that $113 million, what all is included in there?
Yes, I can, if I can get to the Xerox machine, yeah. I can give you a table of the estimated amounts of gross revenue of each jurisdictional carrier. We have that information available.
Okay. Anybody else want to speak to the pipeline section of this bill right now? We saw it came and then left.
He's here.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're
yeah.
Hidden behind there. Do you want to testify?
I'm not prepared to.
Okay.
Could they clarify whether they think they are?
Do you think that it's under APUC jurisdiction on anything?
From the interstate standpoint, my name is Gene Burke, for the record, to Sorrel, Alaska. We have a pipeline which we transfer 30,000 barrels a day, roughly, of refined products from Nipisco to Anchorage. It would appear that this would apply to that, and I have to admit I'm not really up to speed on this intent and the scope of this, but on reading it, looks like it may have some other impacts on anyone who takes ANS oil that's transported down the pipeline and uses it in state. So, but predicate that on the fact that I literally just looked at this about 30 minutes ago.
Okay. Any comments or questions from the committee for Mr. Lohr, or Mr. Braden and Mr. Lewis? Okay. Does anyone else want to testify on the draft CS before us at 574? Okay. In that case, we will hold this and continue trying to figure out a way out of the ticket. Senator Kraft had an idea of just completely exempting all the pipeline language. I don't think that quite works, because obviously the APUC does do some pipeline work, so we will have to figure out a way to get to that. So for the moment, we will put House Bill 574 to the side. Senator Halpern, how soon do you want to do? Well,
we've
got, why don't you just say that you
want to
put that back?
Okay.
I said
that
you want to, but go ahead.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would like to put the provisions on the Office of Public Advocacy back in from the House bill.
Okay.
From our CS.
How about you do that as a conceptual amendment well, just go ahead and do it.
I would move and ask unanimous consent that we reinsert the Office of Public Advocacy provision in whatever version we are sending it.
Okay, there's a motion to put public advocacy back in when we have something to put it into. Any others that were deleted that we should put back in? Okay. Senator Halpin, how soon do you want to start your judiciary meeting?
I've got to work on getting started, but we're going to try and start about 2. But I'm going to have to leave. You got
well,
any bills you want
to the problem is, yeah, we need to bring up House Bill 99, but we don't have Senator Kraft. But I was thinking of doing, she's in a interior meeting. If you need to go ahead and leave, we can do any of these until she gets back. But then I lose my quorum again, and you need to send a caller. So.
Okay, what is 99? Is that something we can do fast, or what is it?
No, 99 is comparable. We're going to have to get a hold of the commissioner to come do her presentation.
I think three
of you. We do. Well, that's really nice of you. Okay, why don't we do an ante? We'll call Commissioner Usera. As soon as we get Senator Kraft back, we will start with House Bill 99.
Okay.
Before you two leave. Senate Labor Congress, will come back to order yet again. It's 5 minutes after 2, still the same day, and we still have Senators Kraft, Collins, and Pierce. Bring up
and
a first
a
hearing on House Bill 99, just as the Commissioner walks in. And we have Lord Otto from Representative Donnelly's office who will give us an overview of the bill as it came over from the House.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Otto. I'm staff counsel to the House Judiciary Committee, and I'm here representing Representative Donnelly. House Bill 99, which in its current form deals with pay equity for state government workers or public employees, was introduced because there's good reason to believe that illegal wage disparities based on sex exist in Alaska state government today. We certainly know that Alaska women working for the state are being paid on average 33% less than their male counterparts, and I understand that those statistics deal with people at different places in the wage scale, so it's certainly not necessarily as meaningful as some people might have that statistic mean. Paying women less than men for doing the same kind of work is just plain wrong, and I'm sure that there's not a member of this committee, at least, that would disagree with that concept. State employees should be based on the value of the work that they perform and not based on whether they are men or women. Two jobs require a high school diploma, a year of experience, and have comparable hazards and responsibilities. Both jobs should be paid equally. HB 99 provides a mechanism to put an end to wage-based sex discrimination in state employment. Aside from the policy reasons for adopting the bill, for those of us who are concerned about saving scarce state resources, we believe that there's another reason to support House Bill 99. Failure to adopt this bill makes a state vulnerable to expensive, time-consuming, and divisive litigation. We should learn from the mistakes that have been made in other states. In Washington, legislators ignored evidence that women in state government were paid less than men and refused to enact legislation similar to House Bill 99. After years of litigation, state employees in Washington achieved pay equity through court action. But the monetary cost to the state was much higher than it would have been if the legislature had voluntarily dealt with the problem. I think we can also learn from the successes that have been achieved in other states. Minnesota is one of the states that voluntarily dealt with the problem of women being paid less than men. In fact, House Bill 99 is modeled directly after the Minnesota legislation. The approach taken in House Bill 99 in Minnesota is this: first, to determine specifically the instances in which we are illegally paying women less than men. Next, to develop a plan to eliminate the sex discrimination. And finally, for future legislatures to phase in implementation based on the future availability of funds. We believe that House Bill 99 promotes fairness in the workplace and recognizes the valuable work that is being performed by the men and women in state government. There is one issue, I think, and the commissioner can correct me because there may be others of which I'm unaware, but I'm aware that there's an issue whether or not it's appropriate to include in this legislation reference to collective bargaining and using collective bargaining as a mechanism or as part of the process in implementing pay equity. The House Judiciary Committee and the House as a whole concluded that it was appropriate that where we have unions representing employees that they ought to be involved in the process of determining the propriety of different job classifications. We believe that fairly strongly. However, I understand that that's something that's open to significant debate, and I have provided the committee with an amendment that was drafted by Terry Kramer to delete all the amendments to collective bargaining if that's what this committee chooses to do. Whether you support it on its merits or whether you support it as a cost-saving measure, I I think the bill's worthy of your support, and I hope you'll pass it out of committee. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Lawyer. Any questions for Ms. Otto?
I do have some.
Senator
with respect to the, in looking at the situation it exists in Alaska, what factors do you think really contribute to the difference in the pay scales? Is there any particular item or things in this state that contribute to that other than perhaps just discrimination against women?
I think it's mostly historical discrimination against women. I think it's mostly different attitudes that have subtly or not so subtly injected themselves into the workplace. I don't believe that there's conscious discrimination. I don't think that people set out to discriminate against women. But there are situations where we have clerk force, for example, doing the same job as people who are called accounting technicians, those kinds of things, where one's dominated by men and one's dominated by women, and the women get paid less. So I think it's historical development. I don't think it's anything that the employer has done wrong. I think it's just ended up that way.
Well, the reason I'm just curious about it is that it seems that given the collective bargaining process that we have, you know, given the way all of the step increases and everything are laid out, are there things such as longevity that women tend to be at a job a shorter length of time than men? Are there other factors other than just either historical discrimination against women that we might need to consider?
Well, to the extent that there are other factors, Madam Chair and Senator Collins, I don't think that this bill definitely doesn't deal with them, and I really don't think it's appropriate to deal with them. If somebody's been in a job longer and has more seniority and more longevity, they ought to be paid more than somebody who's been on a job shorter. That's not what this bill's talking about. And I don't know that there's a remedy for that, and I don't know that it's, you know, like
but
I say.
But is it important to know that so that you know to what degree you have a problem? And maybe the problem, if the problem is due entirely to the fact that women are not being treated equally, then that's one thing. If there are other problems, I guess my point is that I always feel that we have an obligation to the public that when we pass a piece of legislation that's supposed to do something that it really does. And my feeling is if the only problem that exists in state government is that women, for historical reasons or whatever other reason, are being discriminated against, then if you pass this kind of legislation, it might be helpful. But if there are other reasons out there and they're significant and they haven't been addressed, and you haven't done anything, you basically passed a piece of legislation that's just kind of smoke and mirrors.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Collins, that's what the first, as I mentioned earlier, this bill basically takes a three-step approach to the problem. And the first is to do a classification study, which is based on not differences within a specific job class. In other words, it's not based on different steps within the job class. It's based on, you know, I think it's the maximum amount that can be paid to somebody within the class. It's either the maximum or the minimum, but it's on one end of the scale. It doesn't look at longevity. So first you have to look at the current situation and determine where there is illegal sex discrimination going on. Because if there's not, then we don't need to have a remedy. We had done a classification study, I think, in 1985 or 1986. A lot of people were very critical of the methodology used in that study, and certainly it's out of date. So the first step before you can say, that's why we're not writing it into law that you need to fund pay increases right now. We're not writing into law that you need to implement any particular process of achieving pay equity. We're leaving that decision whether or not the plan that the Department of Administration comes up with is appropriate, and whether or not the funding levels are appropriate, that needs to be resolved by future legislatures. This is putting the process into, you know, starting the process going to answer the question that you just asked me. And in the best of all possible worlds, the commissioner would come back and say it's all longevity and it's all experience and it's not based on sex discrimination. Now, the information I have on the differences in job classifications is that that's not what the answer is going to be. But that's the first step.
So this is really a job classification bill as opposed to pay equity bill.
Right. It's a it's It's a mechanism for achieving pay equity.
I guess my problem is I prefer to call things what they are so that people know what we're really getting, so that people don't think that we've done something and then we walk away and in fact we haven't. And we have people with unreasonable expectations thinking that somehow they're going to receive an increase in their salary, and we have the administration scared to death that they're going to have to pay those increases. But in fact, none of that's going to happen, and nobody needs to be afraid of it. And instead of getting a lot of negative input from, like I think the municipality of Anchorage and other areas, we would, I think, not have the problem we're having, and we would let people know that what they're getting is a job classification study that will determine if, in fact, there is a problem out there. And I think that would change, A, people's expectations, and B, perhaps some of the opposition to the bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Collins, I really agree with you, and in fact, I tried to get Ledge Affairs. I think part of the problem is the bill, as it was originally introduced, amended the human rights statutes to write comparable worth into the statutes. That's the bill title and basis, and the bill has been changed dramatically, and I tried to get them to change it specifically for that reason, but that's how the bill was introduced, and that's the process that we follow. The bill doesn't, by the way, affect municipalities at all. Municipalities and private employers have both been excluded from the bill. In earlier versions of the bill, municipalities and private employers were included, and they are no longer.
Speaking of exclusion, why is the railroad excluded?
All those engineers.
50% of the women people graduating from engineering schools are women.
Well, Madam Chair, this is a definition that was picked up from the whistleblower statute, and a former, I believe, president of the Senate and Senate Judiciary Chair had very strong feelings about whether or not the state could appropriately regulate the railroad under the terms that we took possession of the